calendar today. Council, just take your time getting settled. I'll just have the marshal go ahead and call the case so that we have that on the record.
Case D-19-0978, in re the estate of Ronald F. Bundy, deceased.
All right, and I see that council are settling into table. I'll make just a few comments, and this is partly to give you a little bit of time to just sort of settle in and get ready to proceed. So we look forward to our conversation with you today. I'd ask that you, when you approach the lectern, that you take whatever time you need to get settled, organize your materials, adjust the microphone, adjust the height of the lectern, get comfortable. And then before you begin your remarks, if you would identify yourself for the record, as well as the client that you represent, that will make our recording crystal clear. So if you are ready to begin, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, judges of the Court of Appeals. My name is John Trojak, and I represent the appellant, James Brown, in this matter. The issue that is really before the court is whether the appellant made a prima facie case at the court below. A brief summary of how the case got here, I think, is important, even though it's a little bit repetitive. The formal petition for adjudication and testimony and determination of errors and appointment of personal representative was filed on April 26, 2017, and the appellant was appointed the personal representative on June 12th of 2017. And the petition by the appellant as personal representative to determine errors, appropriate distribution, and allowance of the claim, which is before the court today, was filed on April 23rd, 2018. That petition was amended on May 23rd, 2018, and Mr. O'Geely was appointed personal representative November 2nd, 2018, after the appellant resigned. There's a letter from the appellant's personal representative's attorney requesting determination of heirship December 5th, 2018. And the motion for summary judgment and dismissal were brought January 14th, 2019. The hearing on summary judgment was February 11th, 2019. And the order implying determination of heirs was dated a full month later, March 15th, 2019. There was no actual order determining heirship. That order of March 15th was an order for distribution. And the summary judgment order was dated May 1st, 2018. That's the order that we have appealed from. This is a brief summary of the case, not to go over all the facts, but to summarize them. The appellant is a neighbor of the decedent, unrelated by blood or marriage, and he helped the decedent with various tasks from 1995 onward. The decedent fell in July 2019, and he was approximately 70 years old at the time, and appellant effectively became his caretaker. He took him to the physician's appointments. He was his health care agent, and on legal documents with Alina, he was actually listed as the family of the decedent. He visited the decedent daily. He helped him with his use of the bathroom. He cleaned his shower and toilet. He clearly was promised on several occasions that he would receive compensation, and there's no indication of any gratuitous services given the nature of and extent of the cares.
Mr. Trojak, so the evidence that supports that your client was told that he was going to be taken care of in the will, you know, or something to that effect. That was provided by, how was that provided? An affidavit from your client?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, and is that in dispute?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. You know, I have some sympathy for your client, Mr. Trojak, and I will have some questions for the respondent, but you know, the district court concluded that because appellant admitted he was never paid for the services he performed for decedent, never discussed a rate of compensation, never confirmed with the decedent that a will had been prepared, that there was no support for his claim of $30 per hour rate of compensation for 9,000 hours. Is any of that wrong? I.e. that...
No, but those don't apply to the law of quantum merit. If the court reads the Beecham case...
But quantum merit is inapplicable when, first, the value of the services performed cannot be quantified. But second, appellants testified they had no intention of being compensated at the time they acted. Is that true?
No, that was in the Stimmer case.
Mm-hmm.
In the Stimmer case, the parties that made the claim, and actually with an evidentiary hearing, pretty much all the cases that respondent is arguing, we are arguing, are cases where the parties were actually allowed to have an evidentiary hearing. But in that case, the claimant said that they picked the valuation of what they did out of the blue, quote unquote, that's actually in the case.
Well, how did he come up with $30 an hour?
Based on his own work and the work that he's done over time and what his normal hourly rate would be.
Has he ever served as a caretaker before? Anybody else?
Not that I know of, but that issue, if we look again at the Beecham case, that was allowed to be proven by a personal care attendant who was actually allowed to testify in the trial.
That's what you'd want?
Yes. We want the opportunity to present evidence and have the matter heard and not have it summarily decided with a summary judgment, which the courts have universally called a blunt instrument. The courts have universally
said... Well, I don't think it's as blunt as it used to be.
Yeah, I guess not. Yes, that's true. But the important thing is a trial on the merits, and that was accorded every one of the parties in the previous cases.
Does the record indicate once your client found out he wasn't in the will, I mean, get going? I mean, was there any evidence of that?
The only thing that comes close is that I think a week before the man died, he was failing quickly. He couldn't possibly have had the capacity to do anything. So he just couldn't do it. And so...
Does the record indicate, through all the time, I mean, was this about 9 years he was doing this? How long was this?
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Did he ever sort of... Is there any evidence that your client said to the deceased, hey, so am I in the will? Can I see it?
No, he never did that.
Is that a problem?
No, my experience in working in this area is that rarely will...
People always act in good faith?
Well, no, but rarely do people...
People always do what they say they do?
Not necessarily, but
I mean, if that's true, then, boy, all of you would be unemployed.
Yes, Your Honor. No,
And so would we.
What I'm alluding to is normally no one wants to approach someone on as personal a matter as their will or their estate.
Even if they're performing $9,000, or excuse me, 9,152 hours of service, you wouldn't think to say, oh, this is a lot of work. I just want to make sure, I just want to confirm, what you're saying, that you're going to do what you say.
Right. There's nothing really that shows that happened. I mean, he just went along with the repeated promises and was relying on that to be...
In the approximately the 9 years that your client was working for the decedent, when did he designate your client on the Allina form? Was that like in year one? Was that sort of... I'm just curious as to when that was.
I think it was don't hold me to it, but it's in the record that came up in that affidavit. But my best recollection was like 3 or 4 years before he died.
Okay, thank you.
So the court has already covered the issue.
So I guess we did read it.
Yes. And the prima facie case, as we said, Beecham states no legal requirements for any of the factors that the court listed. In fact, it specifically rules out the need for a written contract or previous compensation. In the Beecham case, the trier of fact ordinarily stated that the trier of fact ordinarily determines whether the evidence in the form of conduct and statement of the parties supports a finding of contract implied. And of course, that wasn't afforded here because it was summarily decided without any evidence being taken.
So, counsel, we haven't really talked about the primary, at least the way I read it, the primary summary reason for the district court dismissing Mr. Brown's claim had to do with lack of timeliness.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the statute is fairly clear about when a creditor's claim has to be filed. And that your client did not make the deadlines.
Yes, Your Honor, but that same statute, 524.803, in parent 4, parent, states that if the personal representative brings a petition for allowance of claim, the time bars do not affect it. And in this case, the that's 524.3-803, parent 4, parent II. Any other claim, including claim subject to clause 3, which is the one-year bar, which would otherwise be barred here under upon allowance in the court upon petition of the personal representative of the claimant for cause shown on notice and hearing as the court may direct. So it allows even what would be a bar if the petitioner is the personal representative, which is what the case
so the,
facts do
the
show.
Part of the district court's opinion that grabbed me is in, it's page 5 of the district court's opinion. I think that's what, conclusion of law, number 7. So it says that, it's a little different take from what you just said. It says that if a claim involves the personal representative and if the personal representative's interest is more than $3,000, which it is here, your personal, Mr. Brown's claim, such a claim may be allowed only if presented to the court and is not time barred. And there's the citation, and the judge says these provisions apply to the facts of this case.
And we did point out in our appellant's brief that's a misstatement of that statute.
So the statute doesn't say that?
Doesn't say that.
What
it does
it
not say?
Say
personal representative. It says a claim for personal services.
Well,
clearly
that's also
different.
What your client had, right? It was making a claim.
Yes,
payment
and
for
he
personal.
Had to, by law, bring a petition. And that's why he brought it, because it was more than $3,000. He had to bring it.
Right.
But the very fact that
I think the district court's concern, again, I'm just looking at timeliness for a second.
Okay.
I agree with Judge Connolly's statement. I mean, your client has a very sympathetic position. I mean, he gave from the goodness of his heart, apparently only for many, many years, and helped keep the decedent out of a nursing home. I mean, that's a really admirable thing to do.
Yes, Your Honor.
But in terms of the timeliness of Mr. Brown's claim, right, if he had to present it to the court and he had to do it by a petition, it seems that the statutes are also clear about what that petition has to include, and it has to include the amount of his claim. And he didn't state the amount of his claim until when? It's like it's over a year, right, after the decedent's passing.
Well, there's two different petitions. There is the petition for appointment, but there's the petition for allowance, and that's the one where you have to state the value of the claim. I don't know if I'm out of time. No, I guess not. So that's the petition where you have to show that it's a claim of over $3,000 and that it's for personal services rendered to the decedent. And that's one where you clearly have to have a...
And the deadline for that petition...
There is none, except that, of course, he was discharged. I mean, he resigned in, like, November of 2018, so he really, up to that point, he was the personal representative. So there really is no, that's why that last clause of 3803 says that the time bars fall, because I'm thinking the legislative reason for it is the legislature thinks, well, if the personal representative will allow a claim even a year after it would have been due, which is clause 3, which is clearly contradicted, then if the personal representative can do that, then all time bars fall, because if you can allow a claim a year later, then there is no time bar. So The only thing I could think of is that the reason the legislature would do that is because, in their wisdom, they thought that if a personal representative says or thinks that a claim is reasonable and brings a petition for an allowance, they must be giving up any objection to a time bar and waiving it. And that's what they put into the statute, that that's effectively what he does.
Does the statute at all, Mr. Trojak, provide for any exceptions on the filing and notice provisions, you know, sort of in the interest of justice?
That I'm not sure of. I wouldn't want to argue directly to that.
Because it seems to me that would be, you know, that would be helpful.
Yes. Well, I think the important thing is that this is a court of equity, and that its obligation is to do what is fair, not necessarily rigidly go by the law, but go by equity and fairness and what would be the appropriate thing to do under these circumstances in this particular case. And that's what we would argue that.
Well, thank you. Oh, Council, I'm sorry, you still have 15, 14 okay. seconds. I apologize. Go ahead.
So we just really, I don't know. I'm out, I guess.
So. I'm wrong about that. You did go over the time. But you do know you have 5 minutes for rebuttal, right,
yes,
Council?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm a little taller here. Apologize. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Cantor, K-A-N-T-O-R. In the trial court, I represented Mr. Thomas Bundy. There was an agreement amongst all the respondents and the PR to have one person file the brief and appear just for purposes of judicial economy and not wasting the resources of the estate, so I'll be making the arguments for everyone. I've listened to Mr. Trojak's interactions with you, and I want to clear up a few things from our point of view. The petition as filed in April of 2018, which allowed for, which wanted allowance of a claim based on the ability or the alleged promise to be remembered in a will, is different than the notice of the claim. The notice of the claim to the PR or filing with the court needs to occur within 4 months for a published or within 1 year under all other circumstances. And in this case, what we have, Your Honor, is no notice of this claim until the petition for allowance is filed. And so by saying that everything's complied with by the amended or the petition and then later the amended petition being filed in April is not true. One of the
Contents of a notice include it's the amount of the claim?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't have the statute in front of me. I'm not as I don't have all of them memorized, but it needs to be identified as liquidated, unliquidated, the amount in controversy, and there's a few other things that are needed there. And if you look at the initial filings in January, February, March of 2017, the only thing that Mr. Brown identified in any of those filings was that he was a claimant of the decedent. He was a debtor or a creditor, not that it was liquidated, not that it was unliquidated, the basis for it, the amount, the $30 per hour, any of that. And also contemporaneously
well,
with
what
that,
about, you know, when it says in 524.3-804, failure to describe correctly the security, the nature of any uncertainty, and the due date of a claim not yet due does not invalidate the presentation made. Does that hurt your case?
No, Your Honor. We're not talking about an invalid claim. We're talking about a lack of any claim at all. There has been no notice of the claim except for being listed as a creditor. That is not a notice of a claim. The appellant is arguing and argued at the district court at the hearing and is trying to argue now that merely by listing himself as a creditor, that's sufficient notice. That is not sufficient notice. There is no formal claim. And the judge even, I believe, described it in the in his findings of fact and conclusions of law, where he said to the debtor or to the Mr. Brown's credit, he's not claiming that, he said something along the lines of, he's not making the argument that because I'm the PR, I don't have to give myself notice. So he gave him a little bit of credit for not making that argument. But the simple fact of the matter is, Your Honor, there was no claim made. And if you look at the affidavit of Mr. Dan Kufis, that lack of specificity was actually pointed out to Mr. Brown and his counsel a few months later and went unanswered for, I believe that was in June of 2017, so that would be 10 months until the amended petition. The petition and the amended petition were filed in.
Is there any exceptions for the filing period for when you have to, you know, file your claim against the estate?
Well, I think if you're going to talk about the notice provisions and allowing of a claim, you get into what is talked about in both briefs, which is there is an allowance for late or tardy claims if they're prima facie valid. The initial claim, if it had been filed, you know, at 12 months and one day and stated at 12 months...
What about this claim is not prima facie valid?
That it says...
Do you dispute, by the way, that... the decedent said, I'm going to, you know, whatever he said, I'm going to put you in the will. Do you dispute that?
We don't have any evidence to dispute that at this time.
Do you dispute that he provided services over 9 years to the decedent?
We dispute the amount of the services and the value of the services.
Then why don't you have an evidentiary hearing on that point?
We don't think that an evidentiary hearing is needed, which is why we filed the summary judgment.
You just said... You don't, correct me if I'm wrong, you don't dispute that he provide, there's no dispute that he apparently said this, the decedent said, you know, I'm going to take care of you in the will or whatever he said. There's no dispute that he provided some services over 9 years to the decedent. Am I correct in those 2 points?
That's correct.
You do dispute as to the amount, you know, how many hours and what's the value, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So again, explain to me why you wouldn't have an evidentiary hearing. I mean, that's where presumably you'd be able to cross-examine him. Well, what do you mean 9,000 hours? You know, where's your record? Where's your timekeeping?
Yep.
Or you know, what do you mean $30 an hour? You know, in Dakota County, you know, you weren't a caretaker. You were just kind of doing some general stuff, and you know, that's not $30 an hour. That's you know, whatever it is. Why wouldn't you have an evidentiary hearing on that point? I mean, it seems to me that's precisely what you would do. And then, you know, Mr.
Brown?
Trojak's client would be subject to what I imagine would be very vigorous cross-examination by your part. Then the court will say, well, you know, whatever is going to say.
It goes back to the first question, Your Honor, which is getting past the timeliness. It has to be a prima facie valid claim. And a prima facie valid claim would be a claim that says, I was promised $30 an hour and he never paid me before he died. That is not what the petition said, and that's not what the claim said. The claim says, I was promised to be remembered in the will. That is prima facie invalid. You don't even get to an evidentiary hearing in those circumstances. And when you look at, I'm trying to remember all of your questions in order, but when you get to whether or not it's a prima facie valid claim, if the promise to be remembered in a will is to be termed a prima facie valid claim, it has to comply with statute. It has to either be one, in the will, specifically spelled out, two, unequivocal reference in the will, or three, evidenced by a contemporaneous writing signed by the decedent. None of those three are here. None of those three have been present. Now, if you need an evidentiary hearing on those issues, it would only be if he had been promised compensation. And if you look at the affidavit of Mr. Brown supplied in opposition to the summary judgment motion and in opposition to the motion to dismiss. One of the interesting items there is that in addition to being promised to be remembered in the will, there was a provision that says Mr. Brown and Mr. Sullivan, who is referenced as Sully, were told they were each going to be a 50% recipient of the estate. So what promise is the promise that is going to form the basis of the petition? we have different promises that were made at different times, and the promise that they're proceeding on is the promise to be remembered in the will. It's not the promise to get 50% of the estate. It's not the promise to be paid $30 an hour, $12.67 an hour, anything like that. In order to get to the issue of an evidentiary hearing, you need to have a prima facie valid claim. And the district court judge, Moynihan, went through and looked at this and said it's not a prima facie valid claim. So he looked at, I don't remember the total number of findings of fact, but there's been no argument that any of the findings of fact were erroneous, just that they're irrelevant. There's been only some arguments that a few conclusions of law are wrong. But when you look at the discovery responses, when you look at the arguments in the affidavits and the arguments applying them,
so
the judge did apply the law correctly.
So what then, counsel, in order for this to have been a prima facie case, are you saying then that what needed to be said in the affidavit was, I was promised that I would be justly compensated for all the work I've done over the last 9 years to keep the decedent out of a nursing home? Would that have done it?
That would have done it. There could have been a less specific promise that says, I understand I'd go into the nursing home, but for you, and I'll make sure that you're compensated for it. I mean, there are different words that could be used, but none of those words are present here. And the cases cited by appellant, which say that all of these other cases where an evidentiary hearing was held, and they decided that the various district courts decided that a claim should be allowed under a quantum merit theory, they did not deal with a tardy claim, and they dealt with claims that were prima facie valid. None of those are present here.
You know, Stemmer doesn't seem to be on point, because there, appellants testify that the decedent had never asked for their help. Here, there would be some suggestion that, you know, he didn't go to the nursing home because he was being helped by Mr. Trojak's client. Would you agree with that?
That it's distinguishable just on that basis?
Yes.
Well, I think that if you look at the...
Well, I mean, there's no evidence, I assume, that the decedent said, get off my property, don't help me, I don't like you, right? I mean, and there is evidence that, you know, he was doing all these things for... there seems to be no dispute that he was doing this stuff for 9 years, right?
But there's also evidence that it started far back in time, from much farther back in time than what they're seeking compensation for. If you look at the discovery responses, the work began in 1995, and that was when they were neighbors, good neighbors helping out each other. Proceed to 2007 when the first promise to be remembered in the will happened, 2009 when the first medical issues started happening, and then 2013 when there was the further medical issues with, I believe you were questioning Mr. Trojak about the Allina authorization. So you have a vast period of time where none of this is relevant. It's just out of the goodness of his heart. And so does that...
Right, so maybe that's an argument to knock 9,000 hours down to, I don't know, 2,000 hours.
Well, Your Honor, in Mr. Trojak and Mr. Brown's defense, you know, with candor to tribunal, I don't believe they're going back to 1995. We're just using that as a basis for argument. I believe it only goes back to 2011 or 2009 off the top of my head. I don't remember which date. But it doesn't go back to 2007 when the first promise to be remembered in the will is, and it does not go back to 1995 when the first work was performed. And that's a very big difference in my opinion, because in the Stemmer case where you said there was no request for the work to be done, I don't know that's relevant, because the request for the work to be done here is not, please do the work and I will pay you. It's, I need help with this. And later on it's like, oh, you've been helping me so much, I'm going to do something for you nice in the will. There was no, if you're looking at it from a contractual point of view, there was no offer and acceptance and consideration. It was gratuitous. It was continuous. And at some point, there was a gratuitous offer to be remembered in the will that may have changed to a promise to be remembered in the will. And the claim is being based on a promise to be remembered in the will. Now, during the appellant's argument, he was discussing at length that this is a court of equity and to do what is right by the parties.
Yeah, believe me, I got it. So yeah, yeah. Move on to the next point.
Yeah.
We're an error-correcting court. I got it.
Well, no, but I've got a separate argument with that, Your Honor. Okay. My separate...
That we're an inequitable court?
No, I would not, in good faith, do that in front of the marshals and the possibility of sanctions and contempt. The issue is that in one of the findings of fact, the judge, Judge Moynihan, found that the first notice of the claim was in April of 2018, and until that point, it had been hidden. There's no dispute as to that finding of fact. There's no dispute that finding of fact was clearly erroneous. If we're going to sit in equity and talk about equitable principles, clean hands, all the equitable maxims come into play. And if you're going to file a petition asking to be appointed as PR and a claimant of the decedent at the same time in an amount of $278,500, I believe, $274,500, and not identify the amount and the basis of the claim, and not respond to one of the heir's attorney's requests to identify and quantify the basis of your claim, and wait for 14 months to do so, and have the district court judge make a finding that it was hidden until that time, I don't believe that a court in equity should overturn on those facts.
I need to know, and I'd like to know what Mr. Brown was paid for his personal representative services before he was removed. Was that quantified?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. I might have it in my trial binder.
The attorney may know. I'm just, that
I know
helps
that,
us somewhat.
I know that there was, I believe it was $10,000 initially with another $4,000. So I believe there is, and I could be incorrect, but I believe it could be $14,000.
Thank you.
Okay. And my buzzer is flashing if there's no other questions.
Anything else?
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. And appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the initial petition, the statute does say a claim can be unliquidated. In Black's Law Dictionary, that means there's no fixed dollar value to the claim when it's initially filed.
But would you agree that, I agree with you, but don't you have to say, I've got a claim here for services, for personal caretaker services that I've done for the last 9 years, and, in an amount that I approximately value, in an amount of, approximately several thousand hours of work at a rate that I believe a fair market value would be $30 an hour based on my personal experience of, fixing things up, driving people here, there, and yon, and stuff like that. I mean, the purpose of these claims is to sort of give everybody a notice of like, whoa, something's, here we go, as opposed to, why is Respondent's Counsel wrong when he says, your claim wasn't specific enough? And that all you said was, I was promised to be remembered in the will. You're right. You were promised to be remembered in the will. Here's the lamp. I remembered you, and you always loved that lamp. And so you mentioned it so much, you got it. I have a concern that, the claim... is not specific enough here, and maybe I'm wrong, but
we still argue that yes, it's probably partially counsel's fault. We had some illness in the office, and we didn't get back with parties. But I don't think the appellant should suffer for that. We didn't know exactly what the amount was at the time the petition was filed, so we really couldn't state it, and we didn't know the nature, extent of the services and what he would have valued those services on based on the time that he put in. And so it should have probably been more specific in the beginning. But the statute again says that if the personal representative files a petition for allowance, that there's no time bar, even if it's a year after the claim should have been filed properly. And that's again under 3803 parent, four parent. In this case, there were repeated promises of compensation. Now, our argument is that a layman does not know what a promise to be remembered in a will is and the fact that it's not enforceable in the law. All he knows is he's being offered compensation for all the work that he's done. And the man, if the court looks at the affidavit, Mr. Brown, he was repeatedly asked to help. In fact, he was called in the middle of the night one day when the man fell in his shower and he had to run across the alley to his home and help him. So it isn't, and again, the Beecham case, which has never been responded to by the respondent, doesn't require any stated, it doesn't say that the factors that is needed a written contract or previous discussion of compensation. That's not what's required. And
in the Beecham case, was there a more specific claim? Was there a more specific claim made?
There was, but it was. We don't see what the filings were, so we're not privy to that. All we see is that the evidentiary hearing, they had a personal care attendant come in and testify that if they had been doing what the person had been doing that was the claimant, they would have charged so-and-so, and they felt that was reasonable compensation, and the court found that way in the Beecham case. So in this case, it's not like the estate is being deprived of, the entire estate or something. It's a $1.3 million estate, and he, up until the time he resigned, he had sold all the property, started the tax return preparations, liquidated most everything, and turned over to the new personal representative a $1.3.
And so, counsel, you remind me of Judge Werke's question. Mr. Brown did receive some compensation for his services.
No, he's never received it. It's being contested by the parties. We have a hearing.
That's pending.
That's pending. It's been set. And there again, those kinds of fees are almost always subject to an evidentiary hearing. I mean, the court's not going to just willy-nilly agree that this counsel's time is worth, $700 an hour if the attorney is making the claim, and we've argued that too, in attorney's fees and other types of fees, it's always an evidentiary hearing that's needed. So
counsel, thank you so thank much you, for your arguments and presentation today. Our thanks to counsel for all sides. We greatly appreciate the arguments that you've made to us. The matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. So thank you.